Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We just have Kirk and I here today. How are you, Kirk?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you, sir.
Good, good. I bragged at the beginning of, before the show began, that I have painted more than Kirk has the last week or so. I didn't invite anybody to do a manual labor project, painting 125 feet of decorative wrought iron on the outside of a home we have here in Ohio. And so I became manual labor. I'll tell you what, wielding a file and sandpaper and all of the other implements to take down layers of paint to the original finish, that is a lot of work.
It sounds awful.
Yeah, and then of course the priming, and then three coats of paint after the priming. You know, I was listening to that song, Kirk, and reminded me really I have 17 years left. And those of us in covenant, yeah, I have less than 10. You know, I can't swear that the harvest of Truro is going to take place in 2026. The fall of 2026 is when the tribulation begins. And the reason I can't affirm that one way or another is that the one passage that seems to establish a timeline has it after the harvest is after Israel is thinned at the waist following the demise of Syria and Damascus. And so that would be after the tribulation begins. And you know, keep in mind that our view of tribulation is tainted by Christianity's fixation on it. There really is no Hebrew word that you would call up the title tribulation. It is referred to as the time of Jacob's trouble.
Yeah,
the trouble for Israel. Of course, the worst of that trouble begins at the presentation of Yeshaya 17 with, after the fall of Damascus, Muslims by the millions begin to pour into Israel. And that's right after Israel is thinned at the waist, making the country eminently vulnerable. And Yahweh even says that he's required to bring his children from, and he says this in a number of places, from the north and from around the world where they have been dispersed back to Israel just to protect them because anti-Semitism is going to become so intense. And, of course, that's a derivative now of the millions of Muslims that are migrating out of the Middle East based upon the hell that they have perpetrated upon themselves. But, we're in a position where we will, the world will know whether or not we got it right. mm-hmm. and not too distant future. Whether we're gone, and I think certainly we'll be gone before the second half of the time of Jacob's trouble, before the strike of Apophis, before the nuclear holocaust. But it's that the first 3.5 years, you know, we could actually be here for some of that. So we may have a little more than 10 years left, but the world's only got 17. And then that song that we listened to about this land, we will claim Yisrael as our own. We will, have the opportunity to live there, and it will be a land worth thinking about, because it's going to be returned to the conditions experienced at the Garden of Eden. So it's going to be an extraordinary place, and all the religious rubbish is going to be removed. Before we begin, I want to let listeners know, those who may not have heard via email, that I think it's now the second largest talk radio show. I think it has an audience of 4 or 5 million. Listen live. It's called Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie is the host. I've been on the show twice before, once with George Norrie, and then with the original founder of the program, Art Bell. And I've been asked to be on it again. Lisa Lyons is the producer. She's a good friend of Jerry McLaughlin, and they've arranged for me to be on it again. It's going to be this Sunday evening, starting at 10 o'clock if you're in the Pacific time zone, 1 o'clock in the morning, which would actually be Monday early, but you know, that's Sunday night, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. in the Eastern time zone and wherever you may be. The show, because of the fact that radio now only comprises a small part, terrestrial radio, of a talk show's audience. And we used to talk about this on Shattering Myths all the time, that mm-hmm. that online listens and podcasts and the like make up about 95% of the audience. They claim that they have a 250 million overall listeners per month to their program. And you know, the last time I did either of those two shows, the Art Bell or the George Norrie show, they must have played those shows over and over again a half a dozen times each. So this will be as large an audience as we can speak to. I originally did not think it would happen because lots of times I've talked about the show and it just didn't happen. But I had a very lovely conversation with Lisa Lyons, the producer, and she's asked me to produce the talking points for the show, the marketing outline. She asked me for a bio on me and send all that to them, and they've subsequently sent me releases to sign. And so I would be real surprised now if it didn't happen. So those of you who are night owls and will be up during that time, I'd love for you to call in. It would, you know, the last time I did the show with George Norrie, he was not sympathetic to what I had to say. You know, I was, at the time, this was 12 years ago, I was the first and, at the time, the only person who was saying bluntly that America will fail in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that the invasions were a colossal mistake, and that it was going to be a lose-lose scenario, and talked about Islam and terrorism and the consequence of Muhammad's legacy. And no one wanted to hear it then. Hmm. And at that time, everyone was telling the world that jihad was a peaceful struggle and that Islam was a religion of peace. And I cited the Quran and Hadith and presented the opposite story. And most talk radio hosts didn't want to hear it. But the fact of the matter is, and Lisa Lyons has confirmed this, that they are aware that everything I predicted was going to happen has transpired exactly as I had predicted 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm a prophet, because I'm certainly not, but I read the Islamic
book. You read?
Yeah, I can read. So okay. This show is going to be very little on Islam. We will talk, for credibility purposes, about the predictions I made in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And we're going to talk about the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and fundamentalist Islam. But it's only because George and Ori's two favorite topics are Middle East, the situation in the Middle East, and prophecy. And so it was the perfect way to garner credibility for being right. So everybody doesn't want to hear what I'm going to have to say this time. And have to deal with the fact that nobody wanted to hear it 12 years ago, and yet it was all right. So do you want to take the same gamble and oppose it this time? And we're going to move right into the Yeshaya 17 and 18 prophecies regarding what's going to transpire, how the Syrian war is going to conclude, and what happens immediately thereafter. And then from there into the Genesis timeline and Yah's ultimate return in 2033, and lay it all out on the line and say, this is what we know. Can't wait for the Christian to say, but no one knows the hour or the date, you know. But if you're up and listening, call in by all means. It'll be an interesting time.
Did you get a chance to take a nap before you do this? Because that's too late for you.
Man. You know, I'm an old guy. You know, us old guys, we go to dinner at, 5:30, and we're... we do. And
Things a discount.
Yeah. And we... Because we don't like to wait, and you know, I have a granddaughter, so she eats early too when she's with us. You know, it's a rare night that I'm not in bed by 11 o'clock, and you know, quite often I'll be in bed by 10. So I am not a party animal, and so doing a show that begins at 1 a.m. is not my first choice. But it's too big an audience, too big an opportunity to share, to pass it up. And my convenience is a small price to pay for the potential of being able to share what we have learned. They aren't keen, I understand from Jerry, on bashing Paul. So... I don't know how far I'm going to be able to get into the ultimate prophecies about the Roman Catholic Church and then about Shaul being the plague of death, but that's kind of where I'd hope to end after 2 hours. But 2 hours really is, you know, each segment's about 42 minutes each, so you've got two 42-minute segments, and part of that is the host chatting. So, you know, I'm probably going to have an hour.
People call in?
Oh yeah. Last year, people called in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah. You know what you find in listenership to talk radio is the overwhelming preponderance are truck drivers.
Oh sure, they're up.
Yeah, that's right. They're up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's very late at night doing murals early in my college days, and I would. And it really was. I would listen to talk radio because as I was painting and doing these things when I didn't have time during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it always worked out that way. There was just truck drivers all over the place calling into the
radio. And that's the reason I think sports talk is dominating sports or radio. And second is now country music. And third is talk radio. It's all because of who the audience is on terrestrial radio. It's a lot of it's truck drivers. The internet is providing the remainder of it. Begin just with a quick review of towards the end of Yeshaya, the second chapter, so that we can begin as this chapter 8 or chapter 9 now, and observations for our time drills down into the specific meanings associated with Yeshaya. 3:1, but to have an appreciation of God's perspective on humanity upon his return, let's begin with 2:9. It says, so humankind bows down in submission and fear. each and almost every individual is humiliated and humbled. Therefore, do not accept them. Do not support them. Do not endure them or respect them. Then the haughty and arrogant appearance of the perspective of mankind shall be diminished and degraded, reducing and collapsing the spatial dimensions of those haughty and arrogant individuals. So the set-apart aspect of Yahweh will be inaccessible in that day, which is his day. Now he's speaking of the last 3.5 years, and particularly the last weeks of that 3.5 years before 2033 or 6,000 Yah. Indeed, the day for the approach of Yahweh, of the spiritual implements, by the way, it's not the second coming of Jesus Christ, is it? Indeed, the day for the approach of Yahweh, of the spiritual implements, shall be a time of, oh, great joy for the Christians, celebration for the... No, it doesn't say that, does it? Indeed, the day for the approach of Yahweh, of the spiritual intimates, shall be a time of degrading diminishment for all of the arrogant and haughty elitists who have risen to positions of authority, for those who have ascended to power, and for the highest ranking and most prominent, and likewise for all of the strong and established who whitewash and pave over the highest ranking, most overbearing and haughty, be exalted and honored against all of the high and mighty, especially the religious worship of Allah, as the greatest of Bashan, the serpent.
Wow.
That is the truth, but it is, and it's inevitable, and it's undeniable. But that's what God is saying about his return. And so Christians really have it wrong, as do Muslims. I am against all of the mountainous powers which have sought or ascribed high status for themselves, and against all of those who are exalted and honored. I am against every official and exalted podium and pulpit. I am against every fortified and impregnable barrier and wall. I am against all of the ships of Tarshish, which is a metaphor for America.
Yeah, the United States.
And against all of the vessels and their coveted treasures. So then the arrogant man shall bow down in submission, after being brought down and humbled and then reduced in stature, and the rebellious nature and spatial dimensions of men shall be diminished. Therefore, the set-apart aspect of Yahweh will be unapproachable and inaccessible in that day, which is his day. The artifacts of worship, the ineffectual ideas, the worthless idols, and all the false gods shall utterly and completely go away, be removed, discarded, and vanish. And they will go into the caves and wastelands of rocks and into the holes in the ground from their dread of the presence of Yahweh and from the overwhelming, impressive splendor of his majesty and his stand to inspire the land. And that day, his day, he will throw away human objects of worship, their ineffectual religious ideas, their money, their worthless idols and false gods of gold, which they have made for themselves to provide explanations, pontifications using words while bowing down in worship, giving them to the rodents, to the dung beetles, to the moles. Therefore, they will enter into the crevices and rocks and thus be securely confined for being adversarial and into the fissures of volcanic stone, all from their dread of Yahweh and from the overwhelmingly impressive splendor of his majesty in his stand to inspire the land. You should refrain from approaching, and you should forsake, staying away from the provision and the lot of man, whose conscience promotes hypothetical equivocations, which inflame resentment and kindle animosity because of what man plans and plots. That's Yeshaya, the second half of the second chapter.
Let me ask you quickly about 220, verse 20. How could he possibly have any value on worship and then say that he's going to destroy everything? So worship, if you have an idea that worship is important to him, doesn't this just wipe that out? I mean, wipes out everything. That we do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Why would
but how many times would you have to read that before you say, well, obviously that's not his idea of a good time?
Yeah, the pastor would need to dig deep and make a big donation for the house of God, the big new church.
Yeah.
You know, the Roman Catholic churches, the grand edifices in cities around the world. You know, Muslims build their magnificent mosques, at least from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And God is saying, no, I'm going to torch all that. I'm going to bury it. And not only that, I'm going to diminish and brush aside, bury all the elitists and religious leaders. All traces of religion.
So he's not going to kill them. He's going to diminish them. They're going to still be there.
Yeah, some of them are just going to lose dimensions. They'll be cut down to a singular dimension. They will be infinite in time, but that will be their prison. This leads us to 3:1, and we're going to spend two chapters really considering what Yahweh is saying here in 3:1. He's saying that because of man's propensity to be religious, indeed, behold, henna, look up and pay attention. The upright pillar of the tabernacle, the Edon, the upright one, set into the foundation to hold up the tent of the witness, Yahweh, of the spiritual implements, the Sabbath, the command and control regime of heavenly envoys, is removing, Kur, is taking away, leaving and rejecting from Jerusalem, the source from which teaching and guidance regarding reconciliation flows, and Yahudah to Yah, related to Yah, and beloved of Yah, the support which upholds life, Mashon. Now, Mashon is also the supportive pole, which holds someone and something up. The basic provisions needed for life, and it's from Sha'ah, to support by providing something to lean upon. So Yah was going to remove the support which upholds life, Meshen, and the provisions extended by the shepherd's staff, Mashina, the supplies used to help in some way, specifically a staff used to protect, lead, and rescue sheep. All of the supplies, mishan, provisions for life and assistance, bread, lechem, and all of the supplies, mishan, assistance and provisions of water, mayim. You know, I don't think I want God to tell me that. I'm going to withhold. And it's in context here. There are no chapter divisions, no verse divisions in the prophets. This just flows right out of his, not just condemnation of religion that took place in his expose and condemnation of religion took place in Yeshaya 1 and the first half of 2. He's bearing all artifacts of religion and judging, condemning the purveyors of religion in the second half of 2. And so he says, as a result of that, indeed, behold, that he is going to withhold the provisions of life and the provisions extended by the shepherd's staff. All supplies of bread and water. Now, bread is
It couldn't get any worse other than he wipes you out. You know, he's I'm not going to protect you. I'm not going to supply you with
anything. And by the way, bread isn't bread here.
No, I know. It's a metaphor. But,
you know, it's a metaphor. Metaphor for there is a bread that is really important to the provisions that uphold life, matzah.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to withhold the benefit of matzah.
Yeah.
And water is the source of life. Water is from whence we are born. Water is the ultimate solvent for cleansing. And so that is what's meant by both of those terms that have nothing to do with water and bread. Now, we have been over this before, but Edon versus Edom. I translated it as Edon. It's Eleph, Deleph, Wa, Nun. And as Eleph, that's the ram's head. Deleph, which is the doorway. Wa, which is the pent, tent peg, and Nun, which is the sperm. In the Torah, when Yahweh writes those four letters, he's speaking of the upright pillar that holds up the tent of the witness. It sits right in the middle. And the bigger and the stronger that upright pillar, the larger and more secure the tent of the witness becomes. And the tent of the witness is Yahweh's home while living with his children. So it's the covenant amongst the children. It's a rather important term. And so since that Yahweh is the upright one, Yahweh is the one who stood up for us so we could stand with him. Yahweh is manifest himself to the children of Israel in the tent of the witness. Edon is, when it's used in conjunction with him, is the obvious choice in terms of transliteration and translation. To render it Edon, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, even though I know exactly where you're coming from, I spent probably about 12 hours this week on Edon, and I've never done that before, but the reason I did it was I started back just to go back through the words of Hinnah and Edon. And I wasn't doing it to check and see if we're correct here or we've missed something, because I didn't think I was going to find it again because I never found it before. But my interest in it was, how in the heck can Christianity and scholars read the same material you read and now I'm reading more thoroughly, how can they come up with Lord? It wasn't a question you, it was a question I was questioning them. I said, I just don't understand this. So I went through and went through and went through and went through. Still can't find it there. And everything you state in this section is absolutely on the money. And then more so. And then I found a little program, I guess, and within some stuff I study online with them, where I look up a Hebrew word and I say, and it'll give me everything so-called scholars and theologians say is related to that word. And I never looked at that, and I found about there were 21 words. And then I said, oh, well, this is going to take some time. So I looked up every one of those 21 words plus any root word given to those words, and still trying to figure out, if I was them, how the heck could I come up with Lord? It's not Adon, it's not Adonai, my Lord. Where do you get it? And just, if you're curious, let me tell you what I found on those things.
I am curious. That's for our listeners to know. Can I preface this before we get any deeper? To preface it. Adonai is the word that religious Jews, ever since the exile into Babylon, wrote above Yahweh's name, so they would not say Yahweh's name. They were called Yahoos in Babylon, which besmirched them and their God's name, and they decided they didn't want to hear the term Yahoo, that's the website, by the way, anymore. So they made it illegal to say Yahweh's name and punishable by death. And so that when reading a passage, somebody wouldn't, by chance, read Yahweh, because it's written with, you know, four vowels, so it's easy to pronounce. They wrote Adonai over it. And Adonai is Adon with a Y at the end of it. You know what the Y at the end does with the word, Kirk?
Well, it makes it my.
Correct. That's correct. Yeah, my. And their intent was, my Lord. And, of course, Hebrew has a word for Lord.
Yes, it does.
It's used everywhere. Huh? It's Baal.
Baal.
Yeah, Baal. And Baal is the adversary. Baal is a name and title for Satan. And Yahweh presents himself as our Father, and as a Father, he cannot be a Lord. It's just impossible. So, when you use any translation tool, an interlinear, for example, or you use a lexicon, 100% of them will take LF, Delet, Wa, None, and they will point it. It would be the diacritical marks of the Masoretes. The Masoretes were circa 11th century CE, not BCE, CE, about coterminous with the time of Rambam Maimonides. And they would put diacritical marks on it to pronounce it Adon, and therefore when it's my, it would be Adonai. And therefore, without thinking, every English Bible translation renders it my Lord. Adonai. By the way, Adonai is the name for Adonis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Greek god. In fact, Adonis was the principal god in Ephesus that Yahusha and Yahuchanan spoke so vociferously against. That would be the Lord. And Baal was Bel in Babylon was the Lord. So he was the chief deity in Babylon. Mm-hmm. And so looking at this, I'm of the realization that Yahweh uses the Lord to speak of Satan. And so the first time that I came upon this, I'm saying, what do I do? And usually, Kirk, if you take the time to do a search, you'll find an answer. And
yeah.
I will tell you the answer I found. I didn't spend, I probably did the first time I did it, probably spent the same 12 hours on it. You know,
this is 12 hours in addition to what I already had done.
It's an adventure. And the first thing I learned, because if it's not Yashaya Isaiah, where the vocabulary is extensive and unique to Yashaya, you know, most everything that I read, you know, I don't have to look up the words anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. As a practice, I still look up every word every time. And I do it because each time I have the standard operating procedure, and I just don't vary from it, which is I look at the words, 10 to 20 words, up to see what words are similar, particularly active verbal words that are similar in their construction, and I'll look up and down 10 to 20 words, and I'll always search for the root, if it's a noun, the verbal root of the word. And when I did Adonai, the first thing I saw was that the next word up is Edom, written exactly the same way. and you find that it's used throughout the Torah. And every time it's used in the Torah, it's speaking of the upright pillar of the tabernacle. And you realize, well, that is the ultimate metaphor for Yahweh as Yosha. And so that's how I came to write it as Edon, which is absolutely, totally, and completely justifiable and acceptable transliteration of those letters. Same letters are definitely Edon, and translated upright one or upright pillar. And, you know, it appears in this particular passage. Now, the thing that I always encourage, and, you know, if you had said, I wanted to do it because, you know, Craig, the fact of the matter is, there are hundreds and hundreds of translations and hundreds of scholastic tools, and every one of them renders it as Edon, my Lord. And you are the only person that is rendering it Edon, upright pillar, and upright one. So they're a lot. They have a lot more credibility. They have a lot more accolades. They have fancy degrees. They have more published books. I'm going to check it, because how in the world can you be right and all of them be wrong?
Well, about 8 years ago, that's where I went, or seven, just to make sure. You know, but it was more because of your argument, because you laid it out in your books. Somebody listening hasn't read any of your books, you're always kind enough to say, no, this is why I'm doing it this way. This is what other people are doing, and this is why I've chosen this. And then you go look it up and you say, oh, okay, now I see exactly what he did and why he's doing it. And yeah, you're either going to say that's a good argument, or you want to argue some more about it. But,
right. Yeah, no, I like to do that. I like to say, you know, I'm not claiming that I'm right. I'm going to tell you this is why I made this choice. I want to give you what other people say and the argument that can be made for the other choice. And my view, Kirk, has always been that to translate Yahweh's word, you have to know Yahweh.
Yeah.
You can do better than the English translations without knowing Yahweh. But if you're going to produce something that is more accurate, more consistent with the original intent, you got to know Yahweh. And you need to render, when you're given a choice of meanings, you need to choose the meaning that is most consistent with his nature and purpose.
Right. That's your backdrop. Yeah, you'd have to. And once you do, you and that's actually what I did on a lot of these words. I said, well, that can be a Lord, but it can't be Yahweh, because it's inconsistent with his character.
Right.
You can still have a Lord in the sense that you can have a Lord master over you, a king. You can have a humanly one. You can pretend there's a God out there mastering, you know, over you as well. And you can say, okay, that's my Lord. But we're talking about Yahweh here, and we know that because that's the next word out of his mouth was upright pillar of the tabernacle of Yahweh. So we know which one he's talking about, not obviously
correct.
Not Satan, some guy. So is that consistent with Yahweh? Well, absolutely not. I mean, even the letters shout out the same thing, you know, that it's Yahweh lifting up, not...
Yeah, well, first of all, the ram's hit the ram's head.
Yeah.
A site that says a Christian is saying that, you know, grace is a Old Testament concept. And they were trying to use Paleo Hebrew. And they showed, you know, the first thing was the LF, and they said it's an ox head.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of people that call the LF an ox head.
Yes.
But Mr. Artist...
Mm-hmm.
When you're drawing a cow's head or an ox's head, which shape is it?
A square. It's always bottom.
When you're drawing a deer's head or a lamb's head, which shape is it?
They taper to a point, of course.
The depiction of the first letter, is it tapered to a point or is it square?
It's absolutely a triangle tapering to the point, yeah. With a big
it cannot head. Be. It cannot be an ox head, can it?
No.
And as a ram's head, it is significant. It's Yahweh projecting himself as one of us,
mm-hmm.
as one with his creation, as the leader of the flock.
Yeah, and the whole Abraham story, you know,
yeah.
you have the ram.
The same site, they get to the letter hay.
Mm-hmm.
What their definition of letter hay was. Worship.
Well, why aren't they kneeling down?
Worship.
Why aren't they prostrate like with their head in the dirt?
Of course, man. What does
hay
mean? It's basically we're going to study henna here. It means to observe, to stand up.
Yeah, stand up and look. Behold, wow.
You know, there's
there.
Two hays and henna.
Yeah.
Stand
that's
up.
That's why
Southerners
say hey, they raise their hand.
Right.
Hey.
Oh, my. Hey. Okay, so. Tell us about these words that you found as you chased them down, because I think Edom is one of the.
I didn't come up with this as an association. This is what all the scholars told me. They said if you want to find, basically, it's saying here they are. If, when you want to look up, do your research paper. These are all the things related to it. And the ones that stood out, most of them are like Chizishah. Yah has strengthened and things like that, or. If you start with the first one, which is a base, a pedestal, a foundation, a column, a pillar, a support structure, you can even have the upright pole as being a, when you take down the tent, strike the tent, it could also be a weapon. It could be a spear or a staff. You know, so you have all those images wrapped up in an upright pole or Edom. And then it'll give you all these lists of words and the ones that were, I went through them, most all of them are fib or something to do with that concept of an upright pole. The ones that were interesting, the only way I could support, let's pretend I'm a cricket scholar, and you've hired me to figure out how to say this as Lord. If I went, I only have about six choices of what I can do. You could use, according to this list of things, Gilead is a lord, but it's also the lord of the Palestinians or the Palestinians. So we can strike that away because we know he wasn't the lord of them. I mean, you know Yahweh.
There are no happy, positive, nice G words.
No.
The G word like Gomorrah is, if the word starts with a G, you're not going to find Yahweh there. Gehenna, you know, Gehenna, the rubbish, right, yeah, which was considered the place of death, decay, and dying. Yeah. G words in Hebrew, bad thing. I mean, maybe there is a positive G word, but the moment
there might be one
you begin,
most,
you begin
you can, yeah,
with a word with a G, in Hebrew, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Then you go to something like a brick, and a brick means to kneel down and bow.
Oh, by the way, let me.
It's a foreign word on
top
of
it. Let me just share something with you. You know what the symbol is of the original G that was the G of Gomorrah in Hebrew?
It wasn't a foot.
Nope. No. That's the one that survived Gimel. The original G that did not survive through the time.
It's not the rope.
Yeah, it's infinity.
Oh, okay. So that's the eight.
It's a symbol. Symbol. Yeah, we would do the numeral eight,
uh-huh.
Or infinity. As a matter of fact, what's called Arabic numerals, every single one of them, because mm-hmm. the Arabic alphabet is the Hebrew alphabet. Arabic is Hebrew. There is a variation of every Hebrew letter that is exactly in the same order as what we consider are the numerals 1 through through 9.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the Gan, but you know,
yeah, the Gan.
I have to say the Gan.
Yeah, the Gan.
The Gan
yeah.
is also a rope that binds, it tightens, it twists, it's like
right.
braiding. You know,
right.
So it has once again, it's all negative connotations. Right?
Yeah, and it's of course to be bound for all eternity.
Yeah.
Is the
very good. Yeah,
the
yeah.
Yeah, to be bound for all eternity. So, when you mention the G, now that one's not going to be associated with God. So, let's stay away from that. I say God now. God does not have a G word for His title. It's El Eloah, Elohim. Not the G word that we use for it.
So I was grasping at straws here, trying to find a word that the so-called scholars could come up to support their thesis. Avrek had promised, maybe, but Avrek is to kneel down and bow and pray. So if you believe to kneel down and bow and pray, now remember, Avrek is according to what my research is, a foreign word that was added into the thing, probably from one of their travels to Babylon or whatever. God's not interested in you kneeling down and bowing. He's reaching down to lift you up. He says, stand up, walk with me. You can't be bowing down if you're walking with him. That's axiomatic. So it's like, come on. So I think I have no help.
Barak,
B-R-K. No, Abrek is...
Abrek.
It's a number 86 on the scale. But it's...
an A in the front of it, so it's related to it. And of course, Barak means to kneel down, lift up, and praise. To kneel down to lift up for benefit, to bless in that way. So you, as you studied the word, you did the same thing that I did. In other words, if you look at the rabbinical, the Masoretic vocalization of Adon, all you find is its direct tie to Adonis, but you don't find any linguistic support for Adon. And as you look for Edon, you find Hebrew linguistic support all over the place for upright pillar set into the foundation to lift up the tent of the witness, the tabernacle.
Yeah.
Upright pillar and upright one. And of course, symbolic of the upright pillar of Passover, and the upright pillar is the doorway to life of Pesach Passover.
Let me give you a couple more, just because this is how absurd it becomes, that this is all you can find to help. You've got Tothafoth, T-H-O-T-H, which is interesting. It's the mark on the head that binds.
Okay.
It's a mark on the forehead. It's like, gosh, what do you think of when somebody puts a mark on your head? Number one, you can brand an animal. But you have to think about in the end times when you have to take the mark in order to do business.
Right, the mark.
So that ain't the upright pole, so we can scratch that.
One thing that I just had not thought of before, but we say the mark of the beast, because I don't spend a lot of time in Revelation.
No, I understand.
But there's only one systematic presentation of beast and the Torah prophets and Psalms, and that's in Daniel. And the first beast was Babylon. The second beast was Media Persia. The third beast was Grecian Hellenic Empire of Alexander the Great. It wasn't great in my view. In fact, Hal even talks about specifically how he would die, and how his kingdom was divided among his four generals. Out of the beast that was Greece, and God correctly views Greece as a beast, as opposed to this romantic image that we have of Greece in America, by the most vicious of the beasts, Imperial Rome. And from a perspective of human civilizations, I don't think there's any civilization ever as vicious as Rome, particularly against what God cares about, which is Israel and Jerusalem. But then he says that out of that beast of Imperial Rome will become a beast that will endure right to the last days, to his return, and that that beast will grow out of a little horn, which is, of course, a reference to Paul, the lowly and little one.
Mm-hmm.
And that beast, unlike the previous four, that beast will tread upon the whole world. And there's only one entity that grew out of Imperial Rome. That has influenced the world. It's the Roman Catholic Church.
Roman Church.
And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about how it was not Constantine, but Theodosius who established the Roman Catholic Church as the direct evolution of Imperial Rome. But the reason I mention that is that throughout that presentation, they're all beasts. And so you have the mark of the beast. There's a direct link there to Roman Catholicism. And it's also interesting that in this regard that the Roman Catholic Church, number two highest ranking individual, I think his name is Cardinal Pell, from the land of Oz down under. He was a cardinal head of a number of things, including a Catholic school. And in one particular school that Cardinal Pell, and he's the second highest ranking Roman Catholic, this cardinal in his red giddy-up, is the treasurer. So he controls the money of the Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. second only to the Pope in terms of power. He oversaw a school where there were 33 children in the fourth grade. Of that class of 33 children, 13 committed suicide because they were sexually harassed by priests, and this cardinal knew it and did nothing about it and admitted. He says, I had a tendency when the priest denied it to side with the preservation and the credibility of the church institution. Admitted that. Now, there's a part of the beast, and there's an individual that if he were burned alive in his pretty red robes, I would not shed a tear.
Not a bit. Not a bit.
There is a real animal, and that whole institution is a beast. It's just reprehensible. So you couldn't find
no,
any justification.
I found three more, and this is your last shot if you're trying to save Lord. We have Baal Shephon, which unfortunately turns out to be the only name for the Lord of the Phoenician, which is the Phoenician deity, is Lord, and is the god of the north. Now, that we know that the Phoenician god is not Yahweh. He don't represent them. He's already got his chosen people, so that.
Yeah, and by the way, the Phoenician god was would have been also the god over Lebanon and the god of the Punic Empire, the Carthaginians. So the Lord was the god, the chief god of Babylon and of the Carthaginians and of the Phoenicians and the Canaanites, and it goes on and on and on. And so what you found is, in fact, that if you're going to use Lord as Adonai, then it's indistinguishable from Bel and Baal.
Yeah. Oh, by
and
Bel.
That being the case, according to Yahweh, you're talking about the adversary. Satan.
Yeah. So you I'm slowly putting a noose around. I got about two more times
okay.
of the noose before you work out. You got Shemesh, which is the object of worship.
Yeah. Shemesh
is
the sun. The sun, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Shemesh is sun. And that's the sun as God. And mm-hmm. the Lord of Babylon and all of these ancient civilizations was the sun. So the sun and the Lord were one and the same.
And you got one more goodie. The rest of them are mostly positive or something that you could see an upright pole, but here's the six biggies. A word that we spent a lot of time on in one of the shows, it was Alf. Alf, you know, with Aleph Pei, which is adversarial, but it's also to snort, to hot breath, anger, blaring nostrils.
Yeah.
And now, Yah can get real mad, but he has a cause for it. He's not a mad, vengeful
God. Righteous indignation.
Just because he enjoys it.
Yeah,
and
but Satan is just, indignant. He wants to be worshipped as God. Enjoys it. Enjoys tormenting people. So there's no way to justify it.
There's absolutely, because just because you look up a word and you go to from, give you an example in the Strong's, you go from 134, 136, Edon, and then even there to get to Edon, you have to go to way past, way up earlier to 113, and somebody just said Edon means Lord.
That's right.
Why?
Right.
So
why?
You go through all the associated words, and you say, well, why did, where, and so I was looking for, why did they say it? Not that somebody said it. I could say green means trash. So I'm thinking, where do they justify it? And surely some scholar, somebody that's really smart, should be able to go in there and figure it out. And you've got everything laid out here. And according to them, I'm not using my scholarly or lack thereof, I'm using theirs, and it is no way whatsoever that you can come up with Edon as being Edon as being Edon Lord.
Now,
you have to twist it and twist it and twist it and twist it.
Even before, I think the rabbis existed, but there was some period that the wayward children of Yisrael, Yehudah mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of Babylon after being called Yahoos, never wanted to hear Yahweh's name again. And somebody came up with the idea, well, let's just write, you know, that we've been in Babylon, the God of Babylon is the Lord. Let's just write my Lord instead of Yahweh's name. Let's just say it, and that's what we'll do. And you know, what's amazing here is that Christianity and Islam, they will denounce Hebrew and the Old Testament and Judaism, and yet they accepted the Lord hook, line, and sinker without any justification.
Sure.
Both of them.
Yeah.
It's telling, isn't it?
It is.
I think it's I've gone so far as to say that would Hasatan, the adversary Satan, uses halal to mean that's the version of kosher and Islam. Halal food is acceptable. Anything that is good and acceptable in Islam is halal. And halal is Satan's name. It's halal bin Shakar. That's used twice in Yashayah. We're given his name, halal bin Shakar. Shakar, of course, associated with the sun. And when he chose halal to mean good, Satan did, it was just poking fun at people. They're saying, okay, God, your creation is so effing stupid. I'm going to call in Islam the things that are good halal by my name, and they won't figure it out. They're just too stupid to figure it out. And I think that it's Satan telling God, listen, when I tell you that I'm going to be worshipped as the Most High, yeah, I know that my name and my title that you've given me is the Lord, because that's what I want to do. I want to lord over people. I want to possess them. I want to own them. I want to control them. And so, you just wait. The God of every religion is going to be the Lord, named after me. And even though you condemn that name and title, they're going to think they're worshiping you, when in fact they're worshiping me. It is one of the most egregious sins in the history of mankind.
Unless anyone think it's not a big deal, on the tablet of stones, on the first tablet, with 77 words on it, that's a big deal there. He says, I ain't going to forgive you. Now, you can
stop
and go in the other direction. But
yeah, Roy and I were debating that.
15 billion people are not going to stop going the other direction.
Yeah, Roy and I were debating that this week. I haven't gotten Roy's response to my last response, but clearly the unforgivable sin is negating the value of, diminishing the influence of, having it be for naught, Yahweh's name. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing you could do more egregious, more consistent with the condemnation of the third statement, Yah etched in stone, than replacing his name with Satan's title, the Lord.
So Yahweh must have thought it was pretty important, because that's about all he gave Moses when their first conversation. He says, I'm Yahweh,
yeah.
and Hiya.
My name is Yahweh. Yeah, that's the only name that I ever want to be remembered by and known by. It's my one and only name. And then he says that, you know, when anybody who diminishes the or acknowledges the diminishment or lifts up, accepts the diminishment of my name, Yahweh, I will not forgive. So all of those people calling
well,
him
now,
Lord,
like
quiet at the end of this, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Kirk, he says
mm-hmm.
that no one calling me Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven.
Right.
You cannot call God Lord and be part of his family.
Moshe gave us the Torah, wrote the Torah down from, you know, from dictation. He gave us the tablets, he carried them down that Yahweh wrote with his own hand. So he's presenting the first tablet about Yahweh and his name and how important it is. Then you move fast forward to Dode, who talks about his name all the time and tells us how to read the Torah. And then later
right.
we have Yahusha, who comes in his name. Somebody got to put that together. That name's pretty big and important. Because these are the three big characters in this section you're writing on where you emphasize that. In your commentary. And so when I read that, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, that's pretty darn important. So how do you get around that? You can't get around that. Now, it'll fall on deaf ears because most people don't care. And that's why there's not a great punishment, eternal damnation kind of thing, suffering for people, because they just don't care. If they don't care about you, it's easy to say, well, I can't care about you. I'm not going to waste my time with you if you don't value me at all. That's fair. But these people were absolutely turned around so you couldn't even get there if you wanted to, like these lexicons. If I didn't know better, I could just take it at face value and say, oh, well, I guess the Lord is okay. And his name doesn't mean that much. If I read their stuff, they need to be thrown away. I mean, they need
to. One of the difficulties of translating is that you have to have a filter. You've got to be able to filter out the religious rubbish. You know, every interlinear I use has Yod Heh Wah Heh, and above Yod Heh Wah Heh, they write the Lord.
Yeah, everyone I got says the same thing. I pointed out to people, but I say right over here, it's got the letters, and what does that spell? Does that spell Baal? No. Where's the B then?
No. Right.
You know, it's no B, it's a Yod.
Yeah.
And Yahweh. So, I mean, it's, and they admit it all over the place. So, you know, it's like, I'm not laughing, I don't mean to laugh, it's just, it's comical, it's ridiculous.
It's interesting here, too, that Edon is used specifically to talk about Yahweh being the upright one because he is removing the support which upholds life, the mashin, the supportive pole which holds something up. Again, in this particular case, you have the Edon definition affirmed. By the way, the letters you'd mentioned, it's LF, which is the Almighty God is part of the flock, opening the door, the Delet, to his home while augmenting the lives, that would be the Yod, securing and augmenting the lives with the ten peg of his children, which is the Nun. So, God is part of the flock, opening the door to his home while securing and augmenting the lives of his children.
So, you just proved that he knows how to draw a box if he wanted the Aleph to be a box, a squared number of account.
Yeah, you bet. It's really funny that just the whole thing, Yashi won like three or four, says, you know, a cow knows his mother, and an ass knows its lord.
Knows its lord, doesn't it? It's master. Yeah, it's funny. If you read enough of them, you'll get the jokes.
That's right. Now, what we're going to do here to have a comprehensive understanding of what's being withheld, and, you know, God saying, I'm withholding the provisions which uphold life. I'm withdrawing the shepherd's staff. I'm withdrawing bread and water. And while I don't think there's anyone listening to this program that doesn't know what those four things represent, as it relates to our adoption into the covenant and salvation as part of God's family. The whole purpose of studying His Torah is for us to find affirmations of things. And so we're going to use Henna, since he began this whole conversation. Behold, look up, pay attention, Henna. And then he says, I'm Yahweh, and I'm going to withdraw my support from Yisrael, from Jerusalem and from Yehuda. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at go through the Torah and examine some of the more interesting, the initial and many the subsequent uses of Henna, to see if Henna in and of itself provides the direction and the instruction as to what it is that God is offering his children and what was being withdrawn from and withheld from Jerusalem and Yehuda as a result of their propensity to be religious. So I think that the answer at least to acquiring the provisions of life and even the perspective required to ascertain the basis of these provisions is found in the pronouncement, Yeshayah 3:1, second word, Henna.
Let me jump in one quick question before I do, because as you probably remember, I have to cut out about six-ish. Our time is in, and I hate to miss this, and I feel bad about this, but when we get close to around 6 o'clock, a little after 6, I'm going to have to cut out, but forgive me for that.
The program actually ends at 9 o'clock, and we'll conclude when the broadcast ends. So
okay, well, I didn't want to just leave you.
Yeah, and the reason we're going to conclude is that I'm going to store up all assets for a 1 to 3 o'clock. Opportunity.
Chet is a wonderful sense word, but that's enough of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say I didn't want to leave you in the lurch here all of a sudden. Okay. About six when I cut out. So.
Okay.
I want to get past six. So.
Okay. So, the remainder of what we're going to cover in chapter 9 of observations, and really all of chapter 10, learning why Yahweh uses Henna. What are the circumstances when he deploys Henna? And what we're going to do is follow Henna through the Torah. And what it's ultimately going to do is it's going to take us right through the covenant. Henna is used over and over and over again relative to the terms and conditions of the covenant and even the ultimate test of the covenant. And so we're going to, first God's going to lead up to it. He's going to talk about Henna relative to creation, particularly the Garden of Eden situation. He's going to use it related to the flood. He's going to use it related to Babel. He's going to then use it over and over again relative to the covenant and even the test of Abraham. And so we have, it's one of those things where we have a habit of chasing what's called chasing rabbits, where something will come up and a translation and say, you know, I want to pursue that. Like right now, Shemek is my rabbit. I'm, you know, my second or third chapter just on this one word, which it either means to branch out and grow or just symbolic of a branch and what that represents. Well, we devoted two chapters to henna. And I want to tell you that it was one of the more rewarding investigations I've been part of. When Yahweh uses henna, it really is in our interest to look up and pay attention, to notice the details. So he uses it in the Garden of Eden. It appears as at the impetus for the flood. We'll follow it into Babel, and then throughout the story of the covenant. And I think that, well, I hope that our listeners, Kirk, will be as rewarded as I was when I pursued this. And
yeah, I'm it's certain really thrilling. If you need reinforcement,
really
it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's one of the most enlightening and enriching journeys of discovery that I've ever embarked on. Henna, what a treat it turned out to be. So henna is almost always translated hold. That's just so inadequate. I mean, it's okay. It's not wrong.
It's just
shallow. Incomplete. It's shallow. Yeah, that's good. Shallow. It conveys the idea of looking up and paying attention. It once served as the actual name of the letter he. What we call the he now used to be the henna. It's the person standing up, looking up, reaching up to Yah. It's the one letter that is repeated twice in Yahweh's name. The only character repeated in Yahweh's name. He is also found twice in the verb, Haya, you mentioned it earlier, to be, which God used to convey his very existence when he introduced himself to Moshe. I'd say it's a rather important term. You know, by the way, if henna meant to, or the hay, which was the henna, meant to worship, as that Christian apologist site says, then Yahweh's name would be him worshiping worship. He'd have to say, so what does Yahweh's name mean? Yeah, my name is worshiping.
Worship and increasing your worshiping worship. Yeah.
Yeah, worship and increasing your worship.
No.
Well, Yahweh worshiping himself, or maybe he's worshiping some other. Who knows what he's worshiping? But he's really into it. If that's what the letter makes means. Henna, which is hey, noon, hey. We find the a letter repeated on either side of the nun, which was written using the depiction of a sperm. And while most will say that is actually a seed, you know, seeds don't, from the seed, the root does not grow in that manner. And as a matter of fact, if you put a seed in the ground, what happens is that the plant grows up, not down. And if you were to put a seed at the surface, you're not going to get a root that goes down, and the roots don't move in a serpentine fashion. The roots go straight down. There is just no way to render the nun as a seed. Unless you want to talk about it as seed, as in child, seed as in prodigy, seed as in descendant. It's a sperm.
Yeah. Well, once you just put it in a microscope, then it's obvious.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is absolutely a sperm. It means child. By the way, nun is also a word for child. So the letter, the definition of the name of the letter means child. You know, Ninus, Nimrod, child, son. So it's a mother and father, Abraham and Sarah, standing up, looking up with the child between them. What we have is in Henna, Abraham, Sarah, and Yishak. In Henna, we have the covenant.
Yeah.
Now, while the dual occurrences of the letter He appear in Henna, in Haya, and in Yahweh, don't overlook the fact that those are three extraordinarily important words that have two He's, Henna, Haya, and Yahweh. And these two words, which facilitate our awareness of Yahweh's existence, Henna, Haya, not only are there two He's, the letters set between them are equally revealing. And Haya, which is the basis of Yahweh's name, Abraham and Sarah are represented by the two He's. They reached up to grasp hold of Yahweh's hand, relied on him, and as a result of his provisions, by acting on his instructions, they gave birth to the first child, Ben, born into the covenant family. Ben, by the way, is Beth, which is family home, Nun, which is the sperm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Henna is, in fact, based on Abraham and Sarah, had a child, and that's Henna. It is the first covenant family. Henna is introduced in the opening chapter of the Torah, Bereshit 1:29. Now, so that we can appreciate the context in which it's conveyed, at the conclusion of the fifth day of creation, the Creator said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind," and it was so. And God caused the living creatures of the earth to procreate within their species, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and the mammals of the earth." So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created man, male and female, he created them. Then God dealt down in love to lift them up. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and productive, becoming greater in every way. Fill the earth and exert your influence over it." Bereshit 1:24 through 1:28. God conveyed, "Henna, pay attention. Behold, something important is being accentuated. Be observant now. Look up, listening carefully to the insights being emphasized. Notice the details in this narrative and consider the context, because surely this will change your perspective. I have provided on your behalf every plant producing seeds, which beneficially shows the way to the relationship upon the surface of the entire realm. And also, therefore, every tree whereby a blessing is provided, the means to an upright and elevated existence for those walking the correct way along the path to abundant life. With the fruit of those trees, sowing seeds for your benefit, and for you to approach. They exist for you to be consumed as nourishment." Now, I read that. The first thing that struck me, Kirk, is that why would God say, "Now pay attention, look up to me. The trees have seeds and they produce fruit." It would be redundant for God to restate that he provided plants which yield seeds and trees which bear fruit and reproduce after their kind. He just said that very same thing in Bereshit 1:11-13 when describing the result of the third day. And the fact that they could be eaten was not only obvious, it was irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. It was completely necessary, yeah.
Yeah, that's unlike the instructions soon to be provided in by receipts 2:15 and 17. There was no rationale for the guidance in by receipts 129.
No.
Further,
okay, this rather mundane. It sound so significant either, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is a mundane and repetitive insight on horticulture and biology. Would not follow the first highly charged henna, pay attention, unless God was addressing something else, and simply using plants, trees, and seeds as symbols for something vastly more nourishing, for a more important insight. Now, all one has to do to appreciate this symbolism is understand all these implications is to look at Bereshit 1:14 through 19, where the message of the fourth day is presented. There, Yahweh speaks of the greater and lesser lights in the spiritual realm as serving as signs of the meetings to provide light and enlightenment, but also a separation between light and darkness. Yahweh was using this symbolism to predict his arrival, to fulfill the Moed in year 4000 Yah, and to help us spiritually distinguish between light and darkness, between right and wrong, so that properly enlightened we could choose to separate ourselves from the darkness of man and seek to be set apart to the light of God. Now, while nothing Yahweh has to say about food is invalid, it's almost always a metaphor. Consume that which is provided by God, it's nourishing. We'll live and we'll grow. If we consume human rubbish, that which is tainted and unhealthy, corrupted and perverted, it's going to make us sick. Too much of it will kill us.
Mm-hmm.
When we substitute words for food, in this case the plants and the fruit of the trees, we discover that God has offered his Torah, which will nourish us, while man's corruptions may kill us. What we consume matters. 12 hours studying Edon was nourishing, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's better understanding. I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it? Increase
12 hours of studying Adonai and Baal? Not so much.
No.
Now, this translation of henna, pay attention. Behold, something important is being communicated. Notice an insight that is being accentuated. Be observant right now, without delay, this very instant, standing up, looking up, reaching up, listening carefully to the guidance being emphasized, noticing the details in the narrative while considering the context, because surely what follows will change your perspective. That's an example of a fully amplified definition. That is to say that virtually every connotation that could be derived from the words used in the Torah, the Nabi and the Mizmor, was conveyed in the definition. And in the case of Yeshayah 3:1 and Bereshit 1:29, each of these thoughts seems to apply.
Mm-hmm.
It's all true.
Yeah.
And while this is the first time henna was used, there are 1,000 others, each deployed to encourage us to consider the implications within the context of what precedes it and follows it. Yahweh said, pay attention, behold, something important is being accentuated. Be observant, look up and listen carefully to the insights, and notice the details, and consider the context, because I have provided and produced something, appointing it and placing it before you, and on your behalf, to facilitate your approach and to establish your perspective. Now, that should get our undivided attention. But in Bereshit 1:29, henna was reinforced and expounded upon by one of my very favorite words. And the word that started all of this, Asher.
Mm-hmm.
The very word that led me to Yahweh in the first place. It appeared not once, but twice in this chapter 1 presentation of henna. Asher was used twice. And that's significant. So here at the introduction of henna, we have my favorite word, the word that led me to Yah, twice. fully and accurately defined, Asher conveys that a blessing is being provided by way of a relationship, which reveals the means to an upright and elevated existence for those walking the correct way along the proper path to abundant life. Kirk, did you have the opportunity to examine Asher under a microscope?
Not yet, but
I would encourage you, since we only have four minutes remaining, and we can pick this back up next week.
Okay.
Examine Asher, and what you'll find is, if you look up Asher, the first thing you're going to find is that it's a relative pronoun.
Mm-hmm.
Which, where, you know, that kind of thing. To establish a relationship between things. And then you look and, wait a minute, they list as if it was a different word, Asher, another five or six times.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time it's a blessing. And the next time it's a path to an elevated existence. The next time it's a restrictive route to give life meaning. It's the steps that you would take along the way, the correct path to abundant life. And all of a sudden you say, whoa!
Followers of the way.
Now, I am certain, and in fact, I've come to places where you can just translate Asher as which or that. There are places where it can just be rendered that way. But there's lots of places, for example, as is in the case of this statement that first used of henna, where every part of the full amplified definition of Asher not only applies, but it's what gives the statement meaning. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Asher is the word that led me to Yahweh. For those that don't know, Kirk, you've heard this before, but I was writing Tea with Terrace, and I was trying to track down the possibilities that the prophets just got lucky in predicting Yosha. So I was rendering. I think I picked something like 20 prophecies regarding Yosha. And one of them is the prophecy that he'll be descendant of Dote, of David. And in that prophecy, it's in 2 Samuel, 7th chapter, I think right around the 11th or 12th verse. And it says, when he sins, I will not spare the rod. That's what it says in every English translation. When he sins, I will not spare the rod. And wait a minute! If he sins, then he's being punished for his own account, not for mine. And so I realized that everything I had been led to believe was a farce, if that's what it really said. And so when I looked it up, the word for when was Asher, and that's when I learned that it's a relative pronoun. So it says, when sin is associated with him,
right,
I will not spare the rod. Well, that is exactly, you know, what Yeshaya 53 says.
Like the priest goes on the sheep, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And so it was then that I realized that I cannot trust English translations. And if I wanted to know Yahweh and to know the truth, I was going to have to do my own. And that's when I realized that.
Oh, it was a great day for all of us.
Oh, what a wonderful journey. This one little word. What a wonderful journey it took us all on.
The word.
Exactly. So it was just, and at the time, I just thought of it as a relative pronoun, and therefore it associated with him, and it's resolved the issue and turned it into something profound. And, of course, subsequently, I have learned so much more. Asher tells us so much more about Yahweh and his nature. Well, thank you, Kirk. We'll be together again next week for those who can listen to Coast AM this Sunday evening, early Monday morning. Good night, everyone.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Good night, Kirk. Thank you.